Good morning. Welcome to Senate Finance. Today is Tuesday, January 23rd, 2018. The time is 9:02 a.m. If you're joining us off-net or online, we're in Juneau, Alaska, in the Senate Finance Chambers on the fifth floor. I'm Co-Chairman Anna McKinnon. We will be joined shortly by Co-Chairman Hoffman, who is away on other state business at the moment. Vice Chairman Bishop, Senator Von Imhoff, Senator Machicki will be here shortly, Senator Olson, and Senator Stevens. On today's agenda, we have a presentation from the CEO of the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation by Angela Rodell. And we have the chair of the Board of Trustees, Bill Morin, here too. Is there anything to come before the committee before we begin? Ms. Rodell. Mr. Morin, welcome to Senate Finance. For those that are waking up this morning, we are all thinking about Kodiak specifically. I know that there was an event, an earthquake last night that shook a large perimeter around the epicenter of that earthquake, and that Kodiak did have some evacuation to higher ground, and other communities, even in Juneau, were concerned about the safety of their families and were shooken up by that quake in the early morning. So our thoughts and prayers are with everyone. We believe things are safe this morning and that there are some aftershocks that are still being experienced and seem to be following, at least right now, a normal pattern of smaller quakes after a large eruption. So focusing our attention today on the Permanent Fund Corporation, Ms. Rodell, please present to Senate Finance. If I could, we don't have your document, your annual report that we have a hard copy of available for everyone in the public, but it is available online through the Permanent Fund Corporation, or should be posted also with a link from the Senate Committee, the Senate Finance Committee website. So the documents are all posted online for those who are following us off net.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Angela Rodell. I'm the CEO of the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation. I'm pleased to have with me today Bill Morin, the chairman of the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation Board of Trustees. For the committee's information, Bill was first appointed by Governor Frank Murkowski back in 2006, five, somewhere around there. And then he was subsequently appointed to a four-year term by Governor Palin and a second four-year term by Governor Parnell. And he's still a very important member and chair of the Board of Trustees. So I'm excited to have him here sitting beside me today. So I'm going to start, as I usually do, with the constitutional language, because I think it's important to lay the groundwork with which the Permanent Fund Corporation manages the assets that it has been entrusted with. And the constitutional language is actually quite simple, and it's that at least 25% of all mineral lease, rentals, royalties, proceeds received by the state shall be placed in a permanent fund, the principal of which shall be used only for those income-producing investments designated by law. All income from the fund shall be deposited into the general fund unless otherwise provided. So it's a very simple, straightforward direction as to how the funds that we manage have been generated. Our vision at the corporation, which has been endorsed by the Board of Trustees, is to deliver sustained, compelling investment returns as the United States' leading sovereign endowment manager to benefit all current and future generations of Alaskans. We believe that this reflects the statutory language and intent, as well as board and staff aspirations. It emphasizes maximizing those returns in a fully sustainable manner, and it underscores our intention for the fund to be a perpetual ongoing resource for the state of Alaska. We try to embody our core values of both integrity, stewardship, and a passion for what we do. In fiscal year 16, the Board of Trustees approved a five-year strategic plan. This plan is still in effect, and it has not been amended or changed over the last 3 years that we have been operating under it. Those priorities were to gain greater control of resource allocations, to optimize our operational processes and use of networks and resources, to continue to develop best-in-class investment management capabilities, partnerships, and geographic reach to maximize those investment returns, and along with that, to enhance talent and staff across APFC. This means not only in the front office and investments, but in the middle office and back office that support the work that the investment staff do. So how does the fund actually work? This is a summary page of all the inflows and outflows of the fund and where the controls happen for those funds. So as you'll see, the royalties, any inflation-proofing appropriations, and other appropriations that have been made over the years by the legislature flow into the principal, which is constitutionally protected under Article 9, Section 15 of the Constitution. This money is then invested alongside on a pro rata share with any amounts in the earnings reserve account. The earnings reserve account is the receptacle for all the dividends, all the income, and all the gains made from the investments. And I'm happy to answer any questions as we go along.
Thank you, Ms. Rodale. Senator Machicki.
Just could you explain the mechanism at which time unrealized gain becomes a realized gain, and when does that realized gain get added to the balance, so to speak?
So we prepare monthly financial statements in which, through the chair, Senator Machicki, we prepare financial statements monthly that are unaudited. And that gives us a sense of how much is unrealized and realized from an accounting basis. On an investment basis, those realizing those gains happen through natural financial mechanisms. For example, right now we're seeing a large bull market. Public equities has gotten to be a bigger and bigger allocation because of simply the growth in value in that fund. All of that value is unrealized until which time we go to sell stocks and rebalance and try to take that asset allocation back to its target size. When we direct managers to sell in a rebalancing, the gains made off of that will at that point be attributable to the earnings reserve account. We settle up once a year the net gains and the net losses and post it all to the earnings reserve account on an audited accounting basis. But we're tracking it monthly as we go along.
So, Madam Chair, just a quick follow-up.
Senator Machicki.
So there's a formal monthly balance change of realized gains or losses, and then there's an annual sort of true-up. When does that annual true-up occur?
Through the chair, Senator Machicki, we're required to do it when we close the books on June 30th of each fiscal year by statute.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Machicki. Ms. Riddell, on this point, to put it in layman's terms, and I know some people think it's tongue-in-cheek that my three-year-old grandson might be watching, but it is not tongue-in-cheek. He does actually watch different gavel-to-gavel shows in an effort to see his grandma. And so to put it in simple terms, why this is important for the people of Alaska is while we have a significantly large number of value in our earnings reserve account, not all of it is real money, and that's why Senator Machicki is pointing to unrealized earnings. And is that accurate, Ms. Rodale, that it's not all money, even though it's accounted for in the cash, it is unrealized money that we have an opportunity to receive if we sell things?
Madam Chair, you are correct. The thought is that, so prior to 1997, generally accepted accounting principles counted income. As we saw in the constitutional language, it just refers to income shall be deposited. Income was a very simple concept. It was what you received in cash. 1997, they changed the accounting rules, generally accepted accounting principles changed to include in the concept of income unrealized gains. And there was a recognition at that point by the legislature that you cannot appropriate something that hasn't been realized. You can't spend in actual cash form something that hasn't been realized. And so the concept of statutory net income was then generated to recognize the difference between realized and unrealized income with regard to the permanent fund.
Ms. Riddell, could you state what is currently unrealized in the earnings reserve account as of June 30th?
As of June 30th, audited, it was approximately $13 billion. No, I'm sorry.
$13
billion? Yeah, it is 13. No, it's not unrealized. I will have to get back to you so that I make sure that it's the right number, because I do have it on a slide. $12.8 billion is the actual number. Thank you, Pauline.
Thank you. Unrealized earnings sitting.
That is incorrect. I gave you an incorrect number because that's the amount in the earnings reserve account, not the unrealized portion.
I think it's somewhere above $2 billion is unrealized earnings that we're looking at.
I skipped ahead because I wanted the committee and the chair to understand where I got the 12.8. This is the amount in the earnings reserve account. Unrealized gains in the earnings reserve account is about $3 billion. Unrealized gains in the principal of the account is about $8 billion for a total. And it's why the numbers sound the same, because they're very close when you add the two unrealized gains together.
And again, why that's important to Alaska is that only if we sell the asset do we realize the gain, either sitting in the permanent fund corpus itself or over in the earnings reserve account. And so it's not a trick question, but I did not prep Ms. Rodell, so we're catching her a bit off guard to go back to the financials in June. Senator Von Imhoff.
Thank you. And through the chair, Ms. Rodell, just to also be clear, just because there's earnings, unrealized earnings, doesn't mean that we're going to automatically realize them at the end of the year. It's generally, as markets go, they go up and down throughout the year. And depending on your investment decisions, you may choose to realize them or not realize them at any given time based on any number of factors. So there will always be, and correct me if I'm wrong, some level of unrealized gain in the fund at all times as things change.
Through the chair, Senator Von Imhoff, you're correct, and there can also be unrealized losses that are being carried. If markets are in a sustained down market trend, you could have a period of marked unrealized losses that you're also not recognizing or taking. So you're allowing investments to ride out potentially. And that's one of the things, we're a long-term investor, we're not a short-term investor. So we have taken in the past the opportunity to, when we think that the loss is due to something that is not inherent in the investment itself, to ride that market wave out and carry that investment through a loss period and allow it to regain its value.
Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In the past, a number was given to us on how much the legislature made in appropriations above and beyond the statutory requirements, which was substantial. And I wonder if you have those figures today.
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, I do. We have deposited into the principal of the fund approximately $16 billion attributable to royalties, so what the 25% were entitled to. There's been an additional $16 billion appropriated through the inflation proofing mechanism, and then there's been an additional, on top of that, $7 billion in other appropriations that the legislature has made over the years to the principal of the fund.
So $23 billion.
That is correct, sir.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Machigi, did you have a question?
No, I think it's important that I don't know why the co-chair didn't follow up on the fact that when times have been good, the legislature has gone on a savings spree instead of a spending spree. I'm just amazed that he didn't make that statement. But I think it's important for Alaskans to realize that the importance the legislature has seen in the fund, that when there have been excess funds, it's the reason that we're at $64 billion, if you include unrealized gains right now, or in the ballpark, is largely because of the legislature's eyes on the value of that fund for future generations.
Thank you, Senator Michicki. Senator Stevens.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Riddell, would you explain the $7 billion other? I'm not sure where that comes from.
Through the chair, Senator Stevens, that has been at times. So, for example, when the fund first started, the mechanism was that, and the dividend was created, the mechanism was that any additional monies left behind after the dividend were swept into the corpus. So that would constitute those additional appropriations. Or if there were excess revenues and for whatever reason the legislature determined it was prudent to put a portion of those back into the fund, they deemed it as an appropriate use of excess revenues of the state.
Thank you, Senator Stevens. Thank you, Ms. Riddell. We also, just for those that are following the activities in the state, during that same period of time when oil prices were high, when revenue was in surplus at the state, we paid back the constitutional budget reserve that had been drawn down from other from another revenue dip to the state of Alaska back in the late 80s, early 90s, during that time period when Alaska faced low oil prices and less revenue coming in. So we did, as a group, holistically over legislatures over 20 years, save quite a bit of Alaska's money back in the bank. That's why we have the resource we do today, but it's also why we need to make sure that that money remains guarded both for the people of Alaska and for the savings accounts that help mitigate a state that has, at least in the past, lived on a product that is a commodity that rides up and down, somewhat like a roller coaster. So just your elected folks over the last 20 years have tried to do right by the people of Alaska in regards to both savings and spending. Ms. Riddell, please continue.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So the assets that we have in under authority, both the earnings reserve account and the principal corpus of the permanent fund, are invested as one fund by the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation. We have responsibility for those assets. The Board of Trustees puts together one target asset allocation. This target asset allocation is reviewed each year to make any adjustments or amendments that they may want to make at that time. And then each investment that is made by the corporation is made with a pro rata share of both principal and the earnings reserve account. So there's not a separate asset allocation for the earnings reserve account, and it does not have its own set of investments. One of the things we like to review, and we talked a little bit about it already in committee this morning, is the idea of statutory net income and how this came about. So pursuant to state law, at the end of each fiscal year, we calculate and report on the net realized gains accounted for during the fiscal year. These gains and investment income are the funds that move into the earnings reserve account and are subject to appropriation by a simple majority. Those net realized gains do equal realized gains accumulated minus any realized losses accounted for during that period. And the unrealized gains earned by the principal are part of principal and only until they are realized, at which time they will be transferred to the earnings reserve account. As you can see, since 2013, the amount of statutory net income has hovered around $2 to $3 billion. We expect for fiscal year 2018 to see a larger statutory net income. We're projecting it to be $4.4 billion today. That's largely due to the fact that we're having to do these rebalancing activities that I mentioned earlier, which by selling stocks to trim that asset allocation, by definition, means we're taking the gains on those public equities, and that becomes statutory net income under the definition. So assets under management, the principal has stayed fairly steady between $45 billion to $48.7 billion. This does include the unrealized portion of the principal. And the earnings reserve account has grown from $6 billion in fiscal year 14 to more than $15 billion through December 31st, 2017. The principal is built only through royalty deposits, those inflation-proofing deposits, and other special appropriations. So this speaks to the question that was asked earlier about where the source of various amounts of money have come from on the principal of the fund. Talking about inflation-proofing, the board has emphasized the importance of inflation-proofing. They passed and adopted a resolution 17-01 at the annual meeting in September, directing us to identify and pursue support for inflation-proofing. You can see the historical transfer. This is calculated on the corpus of the fund, so this is on the $40 billion that have been deposited over the last 40 years into the corpus of the fund. That is how these numbers are calculated, and they're based on inflation. In 2010, you'll see a zero transfer. That was due to the fact that there was no inflation that year. 2016, 2017, and 2018, there was not an appropriation for inflation proofing. The governor has requested in his FY19 operating budget two appropriations. The first is to restore inflation proofing for 16, 17, and 18, and a second appropriation for fiscal year 19.
Senator Bishop.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good morning.
Good morning.
Ms. Rodell. Just I want to backspace for a minute. I was kind of waiting for this slide before I asked this question, but the trustees have obviously made it a recommendation here. Where do your new trustees or your seated trustees, do they get, do you have annual education and training for them? Do you send them out maybe to, is there a particular group you send them out to get fiduciary training?
Through the chair, Senator Bishop, we have in the board's charter a requirement for annual education. We provide the trustees with opportunities to go outside for training, but it is not required training. And then we try to provide an education session of some type at each of the quarterly meetings. I don't know if the board chair wants to say anything on this front about training or not.
Mr. Moran, if you could identify yourself for the record so those listening that might not have video can hear your voice.
I'm Bill Moran. I'm the current chair of the Board of Trustees of the Permanent Fund. And I've, you know, in my term there, the training has been fairly extensive in a variety of areas, and it involves both attendance at the kind of a joint annual training session that's put on between the Permanent Fund and the ARM Board. And then, you know, several regularly scheduled sessions with, say, the Callan Group puts on an annual training deal, and they address issues ranging from both the investment side of things to the governance of the large funds like the Permanent Fund. And then, as Angela mentioned, we get some of the top organizations in the country, both from an investment side of things and a governance side of things, to periodically attend meetings of the Board of Trustees, and they put on pretty comprehensive sessions on specific subjects that the Board of Trustees have asked to be updated on.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Bishop. I had a question along a similar lines. Senator Machicki, I'll hold mine. Go ahead.
So on this subject, can you go back to slide 9, please? Just to make sure. Oh, me and other Alaskans understand. If so, obviously this is reflecting assets under management, realized and unrealized gains, or there wouldn't be a change in the principal without the inflation proofing that didn't occur in FY 15, 16, and 17, or 16, 17, and 18. So if it weren't for transfer, if it weren't for inflation proofing, if this slide only captured realized gains, the balance of the corpus would never change.
Through the chair, Senator Michicki, it would change slightly due to the royalty deposits that we continue to get. So you're going to see, in addition, our royalty deposits have been between 200 and 300 million the last couple of years. So it will continue to go up slightly due to those royalty deposits.
Follow up, Senator Michicki.
So all realized gains or losses are reflected in the earnings reserve.
Through the chair, that is correct.
Thank you.
Senator Von Imhoff.
Thank you, through the chair. Ms. Riddell, staying on that slide, do you know of any other foundation endowment or fund in the United States that separates out the principal and then has a separate earnings reserve account where all the earnings goes into this particular account?
Through the chair, Senator Von Imhoff, there is no other fund either in the United States or worldwide that has to separate. This is a unique construct due to our constitutional language.
Okay, so holding that thought, that will permeate, I believe, the rest of this presentation, which I will come back to as you reach subsequent slides. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Von Imhoff. Ms. Riddell, on Senator Bishop's point, we have been following with interest, both from the Senate Finance Committee position and then from my district, in the administration's movement of board members on the management side of the permanent fund. I'm not sure if this should go to the board chair or not, but I am starting to notice a greater frequency of turnover in long-term board members, specifically the public board members. So we're used to the administration moving in and out their representatives on the permanent fund board. But could you speak to the longevity of the current public board members that are on the board?
Madam Chair, I'll take a start at that, and I'll look to the chair if he wants to add to that. The longest-serving trustee public member we have is Carl Brady. He is the current vice chair. He has been on the board since, I believe, 1994, and he may have been off for a four-year period in that time frame, but he has a long-standing history. His four-year term was appointed in 2015 and will expire June 30th, 2019. The second longest serving board member is Bill Moran. He has 10 years of service, and his term expires June 30th, 2018. So he is up this summer. We have a new public member, Craig Richards, who will attend his first meeting now at the February board meeting. And the other public member is Marty Rutherford, and she was appointed in 2016, and her term will expire June 30th, 2020.
Mr. Moran, do we have any indication whether you will be reappointed by this administration or not? Do you know? I can inquire to the administration directly if you're uncomfortable.
I haven't been I haven't been told that I was going to be reappointed or not. So, but to the turnover in the board, my understanding is that for a number of years, up until I believe the Murkowski administration, it was not uncommon for a new governor to go in and change the entire board so that all of the trustees would turn over periodically. as an administration change. And at that time, it was kind of determined that that was awfully disruptive to the overall management of the fund. And it does take time for the fund is a large, complex organization, and it's getting more so as it grows. That wasn't probably the optimum way to run a board of trustees. So the practice since I've been there, at least, has been that, you know, each of the governors as they come in has an opportunity, because the terms are 4 years, to appoint public members to the board as they, you know, as they come through, but there isn't the big turnover. So there is, I guess, some continuity there. As Angela mentioned, I think Carl's been there on and off almost since the fund was created, and I've been there for 10 years, but the balance, two of the trustees are almost by definition going to change regularly, because they're members of the governor's cabinet, and there seems to be a fair amount of turnover there, regardless of the governors that are in. So.
Thank you. From a constituent perspective, at home, I'm sure all constituents in Alaska want to make sure that the corpus is protected. And so this conversation, as the administration pursues a natural gas pipeline, has always been to make sure, at least when they contact me, to protect the permanent fund and to let the permanent fund do what the permanent fund does best, and that is evaluate risk and reward and comply with state statute regarding those risks and board-adopted policies. And so Mr. Richards, as an example, has served on the board before, as I understand it, through the administration when he worked directly for Governor Walker, and now has been appointed as the public member. And so folks at home are just following that carefully, because they have seen him testify before this committee before in regards to his passion about advancing that natural gas pipeline. And so that's why I ask about longevity, and do we have a good foundation for training, as referred to by Senator Bishop, to make sure that we're looking at the long run and the risk that is acceptable to the corporation itself. So I appreciate those comments. If you have others, let me know.
One more observation that to address that particular side of things. A number of years ago, we did a complete review and revision of the board's and the corporation's governance process, and brought it up to kind of the best practices charter for a sovereign wealth fund like the permanent fund. And in that, there's a broad array of investment policies and procedures and risk management observations and guidelines for both the Board of Trustees and the staff. So all of the activities that the trustees engage in terms of asset allocation and investment supervision are against a background of a pretty strong policy base that we use regularly to determine, you know, exposures and investments in a variety of areas. So,
thank you, Chairman Moran. Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Moran, I know that the Chief Investment Officer is critical to the information that you rely upon and the board relies upon, but I'm wondering how important is the longevity and potential turnover of this position in your view, and how much do you rely and your board rely upon our chief investment officer?
Well, the chief investment officer is one of the critical positions in the organization, and the board takes a lot of care in the kind of the vetting of that process. Typically, the executive director has brought a series of candidates before the board when we've needed to make a change, and the board interviews them carefully, and then as they become as they work into the organization, they're supervised pretty closely, at least in the initial few months, just to make sure that they understand what the board's directions are and how we expect it to operate. But I think in the environment that we operate in, I think it's probably realistic to assume that positions like the chief financial officer or chief investment officer are mobile positions. Our investment officers have a lot of international exposure, and there's always people out there looking for talent and offering opportunities, and these are, bright, talented people. So it's probably not realistic to expect that we're going to have, people in there for 10 or 20 years. There's going to be a fair amount of turnover in those positions.
And I appreciate that. It's the board's wisdom, but I'm really pleased to hear that you see that the chief investment officer, wherever that position may be, is critical to the health and a solid permanent fund corporation.
Thank you. We're on slide 11. Ms. Rodell, please continue.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think we've covered the slide, so I'll move on to slide 12, which is how we invest. So starting with the Board of Trustees, as fiduciaries, the trustees have the direct duty to Alaskans in ensuring that the fund is managed and invested in a manner consistent with the legislative findings creating the corporation and the board. Those legislative findings are important because they have not changed since their creation 36 years ago. The permanent fund should provide a means to conserving revenue from mineral resources to benefit all generations of Alaskans. The permanent fund's goal should be to maintain safety of principle while maximizing total return. The fund should be used as a savings device managed to allow the maximum use of disposable income from the fund for the purpose designated by law. So these are the investment responsibilities. They are mandated under 3713.120 of Alaska statutes, and it mandates the use of the prudent investment rule. The Board of Trustees, as fiduciaries, have the full authority to make those investment decisions. They provide the authority to invest within set bands. They approve a target asset allocation, and they adopt an investment policy. It is my job as the Chief Executive Officer to assure that the strategies adopted by the Board are successfully implemented. The Chief Investment Officer then makes those strategic and tactical allocations that will allow the fund to grow in value. And he oversees a group of portfolio managers who are responsible for the investment and performance of each asset class. The portfolio had $64 billion as of the December 31st, 2017. This is the board's target allocation. You'll note that approximately 61% are in public liquid markets, in public equities and fixed income plus, and the balance is in illiquid private market areas ranging from private equity to infrastructure to absolute return. Our actual allocation to public equities right now with the bull market is closer to 44%. That is within the approved band by the Board of Trustees, but we are working on keeping that down closer to the 40% target allocation. So the structure that has been approved basically falls into two categories, growth and income. And growth has a number of different types of securities in it. There's the tradable liquid growth, such as public equities, and there's illiquid growth that comes through private equity, absolute return, also known as hedge funds, and what we call allocation strategies. And allocation strategies are those strategies that overlay an entire portfolio. So they might be a currency hedging program, or they might be a liquidity program, but they affect the entire asset allocation. Under income, that tradable, we have tradable or liquid income in the form of fixed income and cash, and our illiquid income investments come through real estate and infrastructure. So these provide regularized income. They just may not be sold on an open market very quickly. Once again, the Board of Trustees has a priority of working towards an optimal mix of in-house versus external management based on both the resources of the corporation along with the opportunities that we see to take the most value add on this front. In fiscal year 17, approximately 38% of the funds were managed internally. That is up 4% from the amount we managed internally in fiscal year 16.
Senator Bishop.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On that point, there, I think you told us a year ago or 2 years ago, there is a savings by trading in-house. And can you tell us what that delta is again between in-house and out-of-house?
Through the chair, Senator Bishop, that's a hard number actually to pin down. And part of it, the reason it's so hard to pin down is because the fund has grown so much over the last 2 years. So we've had to deploy a lot of money into external managers have gotten their balances increased as well. So it's hard to know where that delta is. One of the things we continue to look at is what are the high cost investments. For example, private equity has higher fees associated with it than public equity does. But private equity is a really important asset class for us to be invested in. And so does it make more sense to grow our ability to do due diligence and direct investing on private equity and take off those higher fees than to hire public equity traders in Juneau? So those are the types of debates that we have. And when we see the opportunities for talent, sort of drives that decision as well.
Thank you.
Senator Von Imhoff.
Thank you. So through the chair, Ms. Rodell, also by having external managers, would you say that it increases the probability or possibility for the permanent fund to be able to co-invest with other large funds who are also customers of those same external managers? Meaning if an external manager, let's just say, is in California and he or she is investing with CalPERS or something along that line, then the permanent fund will be able to have access, let's just say, although you are pretty big, have access to some of these other maybe choice investments around the United States or world because we're able to combine efforts and collectively invest.
Through the chair, Senator Von Imhoff, I think those external managers do provide really interesting opportunities for the fund. They provide with us those opportunities for co-investment that you manage. They let us know about direct investment. They also are a way to understand what's happening all around the world in various economies and whether or not it makes sense to be in certain places or to get out of certain places. And so our external managers are really important partners in understanding what's going on because we can't have offices and we don't want to have offices all around the world.
Thank you.
So looking at that internal versus external management of the fund by asset class, you can see that it differs by the type of investment. So our biggest focus on internal management has been primarily in fixed income. Fixed income plus is how we refer to it over the last 2 years since the board adopted a new asset allocation that allows REITs and listed infrastructure securities to be included in the fixed income portfolio. Those are primarily through external managers. Real estate, our private real estate is 100% internally managed. And you'll see each asset class, except for public-private credit, has some internal management hands on some of the investments in those portfolios. So what is the outcome of this management? As for fiscal year 17, the fund returned 12.89%. The permanent fund, though, is invested for the long term. And so what we really focus on are the five-year returns that we get, because a number of the investments, especially those private market investments, that 40% of the portfolio, is by design expected to be in place 5, 7, 10 years. So when we look at our five-year returns, you'll see that the total fund has returned over the last 5 years 8.85%. This has beaten the passive index benchmark by 1.7%. The passive index benchmark, it's important to note, is all liquid. It has a 60% tilt towards public equities as opposed to the permanent fund, which has a 40% tilt to public equities in terms of the target. And it's what you would generate if you had a computer basically doing the management of the fund. And so what this tells us is what the amount of difference the active management of the corporation has provided in terms of additional return to the permanent fund. In addition, we have a performance benchmark, and these are the individual asset class performance benchmarks accumulated to match the target asset allocation. We beat the performance benchmark by 70 basis points. Again, that gives you a sense of how the active management of corporate staff and those portfolio managers has generated additional return over the last 5 years. And finally, the Board of Trustees has in place a total fund return objective of CPI or inflation plus 5%. 5% plus inflation for the five-year period is calculated at 6.32%, so we were well over that that total fund return objective. In terms of individual asset class performance, this is to give the committee a sense of where those returns were driven over that fiscal year, 3 year, and 5 year. And you can see that, no surprise, U.S. domestic equities was a big push at 14.6% over that five-year period. We also generated significant returns from our private equity asset class, 18.3%, and infrastructure provided another 15% in return to the fund. So these private market asset classes continue to be an important contributor to the overall performance of the fund. Each year, Callan develops for all of their clients a capital markets forecast. So they go through each of the asset categories on the right and calculate a 10-year return forecast for each asset type, along with an annualized standard deviation. And the annualized standard deviation is their expectation or their forecast of how much bandwidth there is around that number. So if you take something like public equities, they're projecting over the 10 years that public global equities will return 7% with a plus or minus of 18.5%. So it's a very volatile up and down type of asset. Compare that to the cash equivalents. They're projected to earn over that same 10-year period 2.27% with only a difference of plus or minus 0.9%. So a lot less volatility in that return. They then use all of these returns and they place it against the board's adopted target asset allocation to come up with a projected total return for the next 10 years based on the board's adopted asset allocation. For 2018, that total return forecast is expected to be 6.5% for the next 10 years.
Senator Von Imhoff.
Thank you. So through the chair, Ms. Rodell, I see the inflation is 2.25, and I was just curious, in your material, does Cowan ever provide also a standard deviation for inflation, at least potentially a range? And while 2.25 seems like a pretty low number, it is a very important number. It factors and permeates throughout future expectations and so forth. So is there a range that you give for inflation?
Through the chair, Senator Von Imhoff, no, there is no range that Cowan provides on inflation. I want to take you a step back, though, just to sort of give you a sense of inflation over the fund. When we look at since inception, you'll see the total fund return objective of CPI plus 5 at 7.67%. That means over the 40 years of the fund, inflation has averaged 2.67%. So to give you some context, for the last 5 years, however, inflation has averaged 1.32%. We know we've been in a low inflation environment. Information coming out now, given high unemployment rates, high valuations on assets, the Fed's need to raise rates, is all giving all the experts that we hear from a sense that inflation will start increasing again. All right.
Slide 23, Senator Bishop.
Thank you, ma'am. Madam Chair, just one quick question, just for my education. These U.S. Treasury inflation-protected securities, are they, am I thinking T-bills, or what? Can you help me here a little bit?
Through the chair, Senator Bishop, these are actual, these are not T-bills. These are a security issued by U.S. Treasury that is designed to move with inflation. So when inflation is low, these actually lose value. They're considered a hedge against inflation.
Then just one quick follow-up, Madam Chair, if I may, is the Global Real Estate Investment Trust. Give me a couple of examples where that's invested or how that's invested.
Through the chair, sure, Senator Bishop.
Or you can get back with me at a later date. That's fine, too.
Global REITs refers to those real estate investment trusts that have exposure to real estate around the world, not just in the United States. So you're getting exposure to real estate. But these are traded securities, so it gets exposure through a liquid market without buying into actual properties directly. So you're buying into the trust that owns the underlying properties, and global REITs versus U.S. REITs just means that they can hold assets around the world.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Bishop. Now slide 24. That's all right. Good question.
On slide 24, I'm gonna take you back a little bit, which is that there's been a lot of the debate around the earnings reserve account sort of started with a conversation or a debate about whether or not the earnings reserve account should be used. And it seems to have, from our standpoint, moved away from that and more towards how the earnings reserve account gets used. And after a lot of conversation, the board, and it specifically Mr. Moran, Chair Moran, requested that Bridgewater, who is one of our partners that has a lot of expertise in portfolio manage, develop and present stress scenarios to the Board of Trustees. These analyses were presented at the December 12th, 13th meeting that was held in Anchorage, and they demonstrate really what the effect of various economic conditions could have, assuming a certain draw requirement on the earnings reserve account. They did two sets. They did a 5.25% draw for years 1 and 2, and a 5% draw for years 3 through 10. And they also did a secondary set, which was 5.25% for years 1 and 2, and 4.5% through years 3 through 10. These analyses estimate the returns required to achieve assumed draw outcomes, and it compared those hurdles to the range of returns implied by both forward-looking Bridgewater assumptions, those Callan estimates I just showed you, and historical returns that have been adjusted for today's cash rates. I wanted to pass along three observations Bridgewater did make in their presentation that I think are important to pass along as we talk about these stress turns. The first is that total returns are likely to be historically low over the next decade, and that's the sense that rates, valuations are at highs and that there's an expectation that they will go lower over the next 10 years. We are in the ninth year of a bull market, and bull markets tend to be between 7 and 10 years. Forecasting future returns is inherently imprecise. However, those low cash rates that we currently see will be a drag on all assets for the medium term. There is confidence that those low cash rates will continue. And this presents, in itself, presents a significant challenge to investors who have spending plans that are based on higher expected returns than are now likely. So the methodology that Bridgewater conducted is that they conducted two stress tests, and those stress tests were distinguished by using the full current balance of the earnings reserve account as of June 30th. So this doesn't recognize any run-up that happened in the first 6 months of fiscal year 18, but rather what those audited balances were on June 30th. So they used $13 billion for the earnings reserve account, rounded up from the 12.8, and they used a second stress test which said that draws could be made, if the earnings reserve account is exhausted, that draws could come out of what they called economic surplus, which is the unrealized gain in the principal account, which once realized would move over to the earnings reserve account. That constitutes an additional $7 billion. So it basically creates a $20 billion buffer. Part of the reason they conducted it this way is that the corporation doesn't have hard rebalancing rules. So it was difficult for them to model all the different behaviors that could happen because rebalancing, we operate within bands, and so we're not forced to rebalance just because we come off of a target asset allocation. The assumptions they made were that the distributions are calculated, as I said, at 5.25% of the 5-year average of the previous 6 years, in years 1 and 2, and 5% off that value in years 3 through 10. In scenario 2, that 5.25% was calculated on the 5-year average of the total fund size for years 1 and 2, and then 4.5% thereafter. Distributions are limited either by the size of the earnings reserve account or the earnings reserve account plus current unrealized gains. Those distributions are prioritized over inflation-proofing payments, but they did allow partial payments. The earnings reserve account could be drawn down to zero but could never have a negative balance. Inflation proofing, just as a reminder, is assessed only on the principal fund balance, excluding any unrealized gain, and it was assumed inflation rate of 2.25%. So what does Scenario 1 tell us? What scenario one, which is the 5.25 stepping down to 5%, is that in order to maintain the $7 billion in unrealized gain plus the $13 billion in the earnings reserve account, the fund will need to earn an annual return over the next 10 years of 6.3%. If the fund earns an annual return of 4.5%, they will draw down the earnings reserve account but still maintain the unrealized gains in the principal account. An annual return of 3.3% will exhaust both the $13 billion in the earnings reserve account along with the $7 billion in unrealized gain. What is the probability of that happening given the volatility of various markets and the bands within which markets can move? To maintain that to have that 6.3% return, the odds of falling short of that 6.3% and missing at least one draw over the next 10 years is 48%. Or if you're an optimist, it means 52% chance of making every single draw. To exhaust the overall surplus, that 3.3%, there's odds of 20% that we will miss a draw contribution under that scenario.
Ms. Rodell, are you familiar with the Monte Carlo runs that the governor did on his initial proposal almost 3 years ago now that painted somewhat of a different picture for at least this committee?
No, Madam Chair, I'm not.
Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So when you say it has a 1 in 5%, does 1 in 20%, does that mean 1 out of every 5 years it could earn 3.3%?
Through the chair, could you repeat that?
You had said that the 3.3 annual rate of return, the probability is 20%?
That is, through the chair, that is correct. So the odds of falling short and missing that target is 20% or 20% of the time or 80% of the time you will beat that target. You will beat that.
So there's the probability of 1 out of 5 years that might happen.
That's one way. That is correct.
Thank you.
For that year that you will miss the 3.3% return.
Senator Machicki.
Wait, just another way to say it is that each year has the same odds, right? So you have to take the years individually. This is interesting. We didn't move a Senate Bill 26 in a vacuum, and you've been here before. Well, I think considering when you think of the relationship of the since inception earnings are 8.79% and your total fund objective is 7.67%, this does not consider the Monte Carlo approach, which has a much lower probability of failure. This seems unrealistically or unnecessarily pessimistic. And I have to also say that any consideration that we have on a POMV requires a evaluation every 3 years on the actual performance of the fund. So I'm not sure how we got there. I'd love to see the background data on how you got to this level of conservatism in 1 year from what we discussed a year ago and 2 years ago.
Senator Von Imhoff.
Thank you. So through the chair, to kind of build on Senator Machicki's, so Ms. Rodell, the two questions that I have, and they're somewhat related, I'd like to kind of bring up, because I attended this Bridgewater presentation. I was there for the entire thing and heard the conversations and heard the questions. So when I asked initially a few slides ago about separating out the earnings reserve account, there was some discussion at this original meeting about how that affects the stress test. So the two questions that I have, and they're related, is to what degree does separating the earnings reserve account from the corpus affect the stress test? And then secondly, kind of more in a philosophical, other foundations across the United States and the world managed to pull 5% a year in perpetuity and yet managed to stay an ongoing concern. So this is done for the last decades successfully. Couple that with no other fund in the United States or the world separates out an earnings reserve account with the corpus. That is a key difference. And so I'd like to hear Ms. Rodell's comments on that.
Madam Chair, if I can, I'd like to go to the next slide, because I think it's really important to note that what slide 29 is telling you is not that it can't be done. I think what it's trying to show you is the stress scenarios. Under what conditions does it make it difficult, or what does this look like under a variety of scenarios? When I go to slide 30, Bridgewater has developed a database over 100 years of securities activity. And they've developed models to create proxies for assets classes that didn't exist 100 years ago. So they have a robust database to which to draw on to do these. Each of the gray lines on this chart represents a different 10-year period applied to the target asset allocation of the fund that the Board of Trustees has passed. This assumes that the Board of Trustees makes no changes as a result of what's happening in the market. It assumes that the trustees make no changes based on what requirements come to them in terms of use of the fund. This is just, if all things being equal, if we continue to manage just like we're currently required to, what could happen if we are required to make this draw? What you will see is that taking, and this is just one example of a 10-year time period, so the blue line highlighting out of all of these grays, and you'll see most of the lines fall well above this. What this line is highlighting is what has happened to the markets from 2007 to 2016. And if we apply that market activity to the current target asset allocation, it would generate the following results, which, as you can see, means that in 2019, the losses of 30% would wipe out the earnings reserve account, which means that there's nothing available to draw because you're not allowed to draw out of the corpus of the account. The fund continues to stay invested. It makes 27.9%, but it hasn't recouped an amount available for a contribution out of the earnings reserve account. And then starting in 2021, those contributions continue to be made going forward through 2027. So all this is designed to do is to gain parameters and understanding. It's not saying you can do it, you can't do it. It's not saying any of that. It's to give information as to what could potentially happen in the event that we have a significant down market, that earnings reserve account has a zero balance, and it's possible.
Ms. Riddell, thank you for those comments. I appreciate them greatly. For me, if we could go back to slide 29, I do have some interest in some of the assumptions to provide this particular analysis. And then for those listening at home, I'm looking at page 20 in the presentation that does talk about the previous 3 years, the previous 5 years, and then the since inception returns that are much higher than that scenario is playing out in its lower cases. As a 3% return or a 4.5 or even the 6.3, which is the green line on the top. The last 3 years, we haven't achieved 6.3. We achieved 6.1. The last 5 years, we've achieved an 8.85. And then first since inception's an 8.79. So we've beaten those market projections consistently. But what I'd like to know about this formula is a couple things. First, in the scenario that was run, does it base the permanent dividend draw in current state statute? Is that included as far as the underlying model calculations for money being removed from the fund, from the interest?
It does not speak to how much is for dividend or other purposes. So it's just saying you pull 5.25%, stepping down to 5%. What happens to that draw amount is not anywhere in this analysis. And to your earlier point, just to be clear, what this analysis is saying is that if you only earned 4.5% per year for the next 10 years, you are going to exhaust the earnings reserve account. If you make more than 4.5%, you will be in that triangle space between the 4.5% line and the 6.3% line. And if you earn 6.3% or better each of those years, you won't use any of the earnings reserve account. And then they assign probabilities to the odds of falling short. So the odds of having a year where you have less than 6.3% is 1 in 2, 50%, 48% to be precise. The odds of having 1 year of having less than a 3.3% or lower is 20%. That's what this slide is saying.
You've stated that well several times now, Ms. Riddell. Thank you. And again, slide 20 reflects the history. My second point is in understanding the calculation is inflation proofing and whether that is included as part of the underlying structure that we can't see on the risk analysis. So have you calculated moving from the earnings reserve to the corpus of the fund inflation proofing?
Yes, this embeds in that annual return, it's embedding a 2.25% inflation amount calculated on what the corpus is moving into that corpus, and it's making that draw second to the contribution of the 5.25% or 5%.
Do you have that number in totality as far as billions that is used in the underlying?
On slide 30, you will see at the end in 2027, there would be cumulative distributions. So it's about two-thirds of the way down. Cumulative distributions to the state of 22, in this stress test, assuming that these market things would happen, of $22.6 billion. And cumulative, you would miss inflation-proofing payments to the tune of a negative $2.6 billion because it's the second priority. You would have a real value of the principal at that point of about $41 billion.
Ms. Riddell, my last question, and I know I have members that are waiting. The amount of time that it took to reach a $10 billion total value was significant, and then to move from 10 to 30 billion was an extremely, it seemed like a long period of time as a person who waited with a small family to receive their annual dividend check. So it was important to my family for that dividend in the October time period to show up. Can you talk about the doubling of the fund? Because I'm still remembering now, actually, since I've been elected, I believe, a value in the $34 billion range, and we're almost doubling that value now. So I know when I was very young, when people talked to me about interest, we talked about doubling your money over a period of time. What is anticipated right now under the current assumptions that the board of directors have placed on asset allocation in that doubling process?
Madam Chair, it's been interesting because if we look to what happened in the financial crisis and we look at the fund values in 2008-2009 timeframe, you'll see that total assets under management were about $29 billion. And so even within just the last 10 years, we are sitting at today approximately $65 billion of assets under management. Obviously, the markets have done really well since that in terms of recovery. But there have been years where it's been flat. I mean, we can look to 2015 as recently as 2015 as a fairly flat return year. But I think probably the biggest contributor to what the fund growth has come from has been removing the allowed list of investments that happened in 2005-2006 timeframe, and giving the trustees the full plate of investments to choose from and using that prudent investor rule as its guideline. And so the Board of Trustees has taken that and put together a very well-rounded, diversified asset allocation and allowed us to get into things like private equity, which has contributed 18% over the last 5 years alone in terms of return and fund value. So I think that has probably been the biggest contributor and will continue to be the biggest contributor going forward in terms of adding value to the fund.
I'll hold my next question. Senator Von Imhoff, followed by Senator Bishop, followed by Senator Hoffman.
Thank you. You know, I can actually wait to listen to my fellow senators, and then I'll follow up.
Senator Bishop.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This stress test, and Senator Machicki brought this out earlier, and I was just reading the analyses, and I didn't see it in there. Did it take into consideration what Senator Machicki said about the three-year adjustment that we had built into the bill, and did it take that into account when it ran the stress test?
Through the chair, no, Senator Bishop. It assumed just a very straightforward draw of 5.25 stepping down to 5.
Thank you. And just a comment, and just to my colleagues and those that might be home, you know, if you read the disclaimer all the way through on this chart, you know, I mean, you know, it's looking in the rearview mirror, and it makes there's just some wiggle room in there. So I think the committee did a pretty good job of taking care of ourselves going forward by putting that three-year look-back average in there. And so I just ask people to read the disclaimer.
Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question is similar in nature to Senator Bishop's. Both versions of Senate Bill 26 treat inflation proofing differently than what the Bridgewater report portrays. Both versions have inflation proofing transfers occurring when the balance of the ERA is more than 4 times the payout. Otherwise, inflation proofing of the entire fund remains in the ERA. And in this, both the House and the Senate took a lot of time and effort in its deliberations in coming up with this method in both bodies. And I know that it isn't the law of the land, but it's farther than anything else on how we are going to decide how to use the permanent fund for government. And I'm wondering why there wasn't an addendum or a stress test to look at the versions that the legislature had passed and what impacts that would have on a stress test. Because I think it wouldn't be as bleak as what we're looking at in the charts that
right,
we have
on 29 and
on 30, where the bottom line in 2019 we have a real value of the principal at $40.4 billion, and we don't surpass that in 19 until we get out to 2026, when we finally pass that by 200 to 40.6. So there's a 7-year period where we're trying to catch up because of that 1 year of 30% loss.
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, we specifically did not ask for any particular bill to be modeled because of there's a lot of moving parts, and that inflation, that 4 years, is a challenging calculation because the timing is not clear between the two bills. Just to give you a sense of the difference between the House and the Senate version on that inflation proofing mechanism that is in that bill, the House has a different calculation because they include a 25% allocation. So it would be closer to actual inflation. The Senate version has everything above the four times move over, which would be a contribution to the corpus of in excess of $5 billion this year.
But both of them are closer to anything than what is being presented by the Bridgewater report. And the Bridgewater report, with that one assumption of 2008 filtering through to 2019 and having a 30% asset portfolio loss is substantial.
Through the chair, I think it's important to note that what this analysis is doing is applying a specific time period of actual results on balances going forward. So they're assuming inflation is 2.25% and that we lose money during this financial crisis time period, which then requires that the distribution to the state be made first ahead of inflation proofing. And that was because we had to create a waterfall for those distributions. But you are correct that actual inflation contributions as calculated under the governor's operating budget would restore almost $2 billion to the corpus of the fund.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Hoffman, Senator Lamont-Imhoff, followed by Senator Michiki.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Okay, so these slides are interesting, but I think more in an academic sense. I think we're getting sidetracked on the real conversation here. How do other foundations differently manage their assets and successfully have a 5% draw on a perpetual basis and manage to maintain as an ongoing concern?
Through the chair, Senator Von Imhoff, I don't have an answer for that question. I can tell you that from looking at things like the Yale Endowment, which has always been held up as a premier endowment to be modeled after, is that the calculation of 5% is based on 5% of spending. So 5% of the spending, and the spending gets adjusted down or up depending on what that draw is. It's not based on 5% of the value of the endowment. So there's a lot of different rules depending on which endowment you're talking about, and I don't have an answer for you as to what is the best way forward on this. This analysis is simply designed to give you information about what could happen if we have a really wretched set of market circumstances, because we know that markets go down. We know that. History tells us that we will hit a point at which the market is going to go down. And this is just pointing out what could happen if all things being equal and we don't change the target asset allocation. Because one of the things that is available to the Board of Trustees is that if this happens, the board can change the target asset allocation, move it away from volatile markets like public equities, put it into fixed income, and returns will go down accordingly. That is an option on the table that this doesn't model. So I don't have an answer to your question.
Senator Michiki.
This is, do you feel tense a little? This is a healthy tension, right? And why it's healthy is because we have two different objectives. And your objective is maximum returns, as you're charged to do. And our objective is to manage our state assets conservatively and think about how we balance that with delivering state services, right? And what your report is saying, although since inception we've earned 8.79% and your objective is 7.67, is that with no changes, so you're not talking about the fact that we have a spending limit that won't take the max draw when we hit a certain level of revenue, you're not talking about our inflation-proofing mechanism, you're saying with this set of assumptions, which is very stagnant, static, at 5.25%, to 5 in 3 years, that there's a 80% chance that we meet our goals of not exhausting overall surplus. There's a 70% chance of not exhausting our earnings reserve. And there's a 52% chance that there's no problem whatsoever.
That is correct.
And that doesn't take into account that we will evaluate that draw, that we have an inflation-proofing mechanism, that on years when we have higher revenue, we're not going to take the draw. It's just saying, with that static assumption, be careful. And I understand it took a while to get through. I'm not sure the public will get to that point because we're concentrated on this today. But it's a healthy tension, and I'm glad you have your objectives. And I think it's the right way to look at it, that we have to be as careful as possible to ensure that we don't stress growth of the corpus of the Alaska Permanent Fund, that incredible asset that we have available to us. So I get there. I mean, there are many funds that rely on that draw and adjust accordingly. We may have to adjust accordingly on our side and yours. And we're not even bringing the CBR discussion into this. The CBR discussion is something that I don't think we made the right decisions early on how the CBR is looked at for a relatively low return savings account that has cost us billions of dollars over the years. I think it's time for that conversation, particularly if and when we replenish those savings about how they're managed. I don't think we made the right decisions. We're an infant state that I think it's a good time to evaluate a lot of that logic.
Senator Von Imhoff.
Thank you. Angela, Ms. Riddell, I thank you for being here and allowing us to interrogate you. I'm very fond of you on a personal note, so just know that I come from a place of I'm just trying to do what's right by the state. My concern of why I'm pushing is that we have $13 billion in this ERA, and I want to make sure we don't go through it in the next several years. I want to protect the permanent fund, and I want to look at doing a structured draw that's controlled, predictable, and sustainable over time. That's my objective. So in 2004-ish, I think the board recommended that the earnings reserve account, they look at collapsing it into the corpus to make it one large fund. And there's a reason why they did that. And that is because over time, generally having the whole fund be able to capture the excess income over time helps the fund grow. It's like super inflation proofing it. There will be years where the fund will, returns will be negative. I've lived through them. I sit on two private foundations myself now. We've lived through it. I also attend the National Council of Foundations and have talked to various different foundations, as well as attended NMS conference and talked about investments. A 5% draw with a 5%, not 5.25%, but 5% with a 5-year look back of market value is a conservative approach and works over time, especially if you're not siphoning the annual returns into a special ERA account. Also, you made a comment, is assuming that we continue to manage the exact same way as we currently are required to do. Well, it's because you have an ERA and a corpus. If we change it in order to accommodate this 5% draw, you like you said, we would probably change how we manage a little bit potentially, and I would argue that it will be better than what it is now. Not that you're not managing it well, but that you would manage 4 or 5% draw that successfully works in many parts of the world. One last comment is that we have the mental health fund here in Alaska. It's a 4.5% draw on an annual basis, and it's worked over time. Thank you.
Other questions from committee members? Ms. Riddell, I have two questions. One, I appreciate the conservative look from you, from the board chair, to protect the corpus of the permanent fund, which in my view has been the goal of this administration and all legislators, whether they're for or against a particular draw. But knowing that we've been in a bull market for so long, given your experience with the market, like Senator Von Imhoff, all of us have experienced the 2007-2008 collapse of at least the American economy and the stock market. We saw great losses in permanent fund earnings for those particular downward cycle quarters, and your investors, our investors nationwide, stepped up to the challenge and stopped the bleeding that we had seen in previous loss scenarios. So that stages the question on how are we prepared for a bear market, and do we have an evacuation plan, an emergency plan set up for when the bear arrives versus the bull?
You know, the challenge with that question is not knowing when or where the bear comes. We just know it's sitting out there. So the steps that we've been taking that are different than where the fund was at in that 08-09 timeframe is that we have put together a hedge fund strategy that is non-correlated or counter-cyclical to what's happening in the market, which will, in theory, protect us from some of the downside. You usually don't see that bear market come through in some of the private equity, and there's been a global diversification in a way that we weren't at 10 years ago. So the combination of both the asset class diversification along with the global diversification, we believe has put us in a position to weather that. We continue to have, we will have losses. I mean, we're not going to prevent losses. And one of the true tests of our asset allocation that we haven't seen yet, because we're in a 9-year bull market, is how well we have prepared for that bear market, because until it comes, we won't have a good sense. One of the things also that the investment policies and the board is very good at is being very quick and nimble to react when the need arises to do that on a variety of different fronts. So I suspect that we would be convening very quickly to make sure that the things we've tried to put in place are working as we've expected.
Mr. Riddell, thank you. And just like the rodeo that we live in volatility when it comes to oil and gas production, we have lived in the same rodeo when it comes to investment earnings over time. And so I appreciate the cautionary note of the previous scenario. I know you have another scenario to describe to us, or I believe you do. So let's move on. One final point that I have, but Senator Hoffman, please first.
Well, my point is that I think the House and the Senate have passed versions of Senate Bill 26, and I think that the payout that we have, although Senator Von Imhoff is talking about a stable 5%, the House, the Senate's version is even more conservative than that, which would, in my view, strongly reduce the stress test, and we have a 4.5 to 4.75%, which is much more conservative, and in my view is protects the corpus and protects the balance of the ERA. And I'm wondering if you might comment on that.
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, that is the next scenario that I'm going to walk through.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Riddell, the last thought that I wrote down was the move last year to take all of the money from the ERA to fund government, and the shock that reverberated based on that move with board members and the corporation itself. And so one of our senators has named it the turducken, that we somehow, the House in its wisdom decided that it would be a good idea to place the capital budget inside of the operating budget, take all the money from the ERA, and cut and run. That's a Senate version. I mean that tongue-in-cheek. Our colleagues were just as frustrated as the Senate was in trying to reach a compromise and felt like that was an option that they would place on the field for consideration. I mean that with all respect. But if you could just briefly talk at this Finance Committee table, how that vibrated in your world as far as management and why we're seeing, which again I appreciate, the lights on scenario, make sure, Senate Finance, that you understand that there can be a down market. Make sure, Alaska, that you understand we live in volatility that we do not control, we manage. So we are at the rodeo. We are riding on interest as a source of income. We are at the rodeo riding on a commodity. And we have some less robust broncos or whatever you ride at a rodeo, bulls. Some more tame, some older ones that provide earning in the form of tourism and other things. So we're participating. Can you just speak to not a good analogy? I'm sorry, I just don't know sports well enough to get on a football field and talk about blitzes or whatever those things are.
Madam Chair, going back to your question about I guess the legislative session in 2017, there was a lot of discussion, as I said at the beginning of my remarks, about how to use the fund. And we need at the fund approximately, we keep about $1 billion of cash on hand in order to, whether it's to fund operations, to pay external managers, but also to meet those capital calls. As the debate was happening, it looked like to us from the outside looking in that there was consensus building around this $2.5, $2.7 billion draw that was going to be in SB 26, which I believe sort of coalesced in March sometime. And so we started pointing our cash reserves towards a $3.5 billion mark. So the $1 billion for ourselves, the $2.5 billion for the state of Alaska. In terms of planning, that's really important because we then are not going to deploy that cash into an illiquid asset class such as private equity, because we know we can't get it back out to then turn over to Treasury. And even knowing that it might be July 1st or it might be September 1st or it might even be January 1st when Treasury needs that money, it meant that we were going to be in a short-term duration, 3 to 9 months of use of that funds, which argues for moving into very liquid fixed income securities that aren't going to lose value. So that is the tactic that we took. Then the debate continued on, and the amount moved off of that roughly $2.5 billion mark, moved up closer to $5 billion. And then ultimately resulted in a total draw of about $725 million. And so we immediately, once that $725 million draw was settled on and agreed upon and wasn't going to change, we immediately deployed that last week in June, that excess over the 1.7. So we held $1 billion for us, the $725 million for the state, and the balance was then immediately deployed into the markets, into primarily the public equities and fixed income because they're the most liquid. And then we've been moving it into private assets as they become available.
Senator Hoffman, did you have a question?
No.
Ms. Riddell, there is this notion that's traveling through the legislature this year about advance funding a portion of the budget. I know that you and I met in regards to your constitutional authority and whether you had it or not to actually deploy money managers on the behalf of Alaskans in the case of a government shutdown. Do you have any comments for that? Certainly, I would be protective of both the retirement board in being able to provide benefits to Alaskans, as well as the Permanent Fund Corporation in its ability to manage a huge asset if that conversation gains any legs in either one or both bodies, because I believe that you need the statutory authority to operate. Can you speak to that?
Thank you, Madam Chair. We are required to have an appropriation to operate. And so that appropriation pays for both the corporate operations as well as those external manager contracts where we write actual checks. They're not a net of fee arrangement. And so in the event of a shutdown, we have made provisions with the custodial bank, Bank of New York Mellon. There are also those provisions that would come into effect if there were a tsunami that prevented us from getting in and managing the fund. There are emergency procedures, and they would take over management of the fund, but they wouldn't actively manage. So in other words, they're going to act as the receiver and collect and book those income receipts, but they're not going to make reinvestment decisions. They're not going to make active management decisions. So if the market goes sideways, they're not going to take action to mitigate that.
Thank you. Moving on to slide 31.
So this was the second scenario, which was to continue with that 5.25% for years 1 and 2, recognizing that there needed to be sort of a budgetary glide path into an ongoing endowment or an ongoing draw of 4.5% in years 3 through 10. So as you would expect, that required annual return then steps down because the required amount is stepped down. So in this scenario, in order to maintain both the $13 billion in the earnings reserve as well as the $7 billion in the unrealized gain, you would need to earn an annual return of 5.9% over the next 10 years. In order to maintain that $13 billion, the $7 billion in unrealized but utilize all of the earnings reserve account requires an annual return of 4.1%. And then you would exhaust both the earnings reserve account and the unrealized gain if you only earned 2.9% annual return. And just to sort of give some context to this, fixed income 10-year treasury rates are slightly below 2.9% today. So if this were all in treasuries, you would exhaust the earnings reserve account as well as the unrealized gains.
Senator Von Imhoff.
Ms. Riddell, do you think that if we didn't have the bump down, as in we did not start at 5.25 and either bumped it to 5 or 4.5, if we just started it at 5, how would, in your opinion, how would this risk profile shift?
Through the Chair, Senator Von Imhoff, I think it would shift, both of them would, well, the other one would shift down slightly. This might shift up slightly because you're doing a 7-year period at 5 rather than a 7-year period at 4.5. So they would probably meet somewhere between the 5.9 and the 6.3%.
Okay, so through the chair, you don't think the shock at the beginning of 5.25 has that much of an effect that both would shift down in risk if we just limited it that quarter?
Through the chair, no, and part of that is because while you're eliminating the shock in this scenario for the first 2 years, you're increasing the distribution requirement in years 3 through 10 from 4.5 to 5.
Okay. Any other questions? Please continue.
And you can see, and I think this would be intuitive, that then the odds of falling short or if you, the odds of falling short go down as well. So the odds of falling short, or the odds of maintaining and making that 5.9% annual return, would actually be 56%, so better than half, one out of two chance that you would make your 5.9% return.
Ms. Riddell, is your staffing level affected at all by the proposals that have been before the legislature? Will you need more staff to manage more volatility or more liquidity?
Madam Chair, our staffing levels are affected more by, believe it or not, I would say, the plan. So in the sense of not knowing what the environment is going forward makes it hard for us to determine the best route. I mean, we keep talking about internal versus external management. And the biggest value of internal management is really in the private markets, but that's a very illiquid place to be. And so if the plan going forward is going to require us to maintain higher degrees of liquidity, it's less likely that we would put those internal resources into something like private markets, because that asset allocation is going to have to go down or stay where it currently potentially is, possibly. And it's because of the not knowing going forward. So this is all speculative. And part of it is, too, because if you remember, those spending plans or those staffing plans are built 2 years out. So it's where you want to be at the end of a fiscal year cycle, not at the beginning of the fiscal year, because you don't have all those people on board on day one. You're using the course of the fiscal year and the budgetary authority you've been given to build up those staffing levels and be in a certain place at the end of the year. So we're putting together a two-year business plan without having clarity as to what the fund should look like given any possible changes. So we're having to do it as if the current environment is going to continue.
Thank you. Please continue.
So on slide 33, we applied the same stress test that you saw earlier to the new 5.25%, stepping down to the 4.5%. And in this case, you can see that the cumulative distributions are lower, and that should be expected because you're taking less at 4.5%. But you still have the same effect of a big market sell-off in the second year of 30% with a 27% recovery the following year. So if I can move on to the comparison between the two, you'll see that the two are fairly close, but they do provide a range of outcomes. At the end of 10 years, based on Callan's capital market forecast, you would have distributed under the base case a total of $31,521,000,000, which is different than the stress case. This is just under the median outcomes. You will have distributed $31 billion, and in the reduced distribution, a total of $29 billion. The fund will have grown to $75.3 billion, or $78.2 billion under the lower 4.5% draw. The earnings reserve will continue to accumulate at $14.3 billion. You will have built up an unrealized gain because we don't do any rebalancing, so those unrealized gains are allowed to accumulate to $21.4 billion, and you will have not missed any inflation-proofing payments. So this is the median case under these scenarios where you earn 6.3% and 5.9%.
Ms. Riddell, when the legislature added additional funds to the Permanent Fund Corporation through its revenue, that's just taken as more versus inflation proofing because of the statutory language that was used?
That is correct. And in those years, the legislature also appropriated specific inflation-proofing payments.
Thank you.
This is just an appendix I included for your information, our December 31st financial statements. I won't go through them unless there are specific questions you have. And I would just offer up any other questions, but that concludes our presentation.
Questions from committee members. Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Going back and looking at the governor's budget, it's portrayed that we have about a $2.5 billion deficit. And notwithstanding, we're looking at 26 or what are we? How the permanent fund is going to be utilized? But if you look at his $2.5 billion deficit, he's also short funding credits that may not happen if we don't sell the bonds, about $200 million and maybe $60 million in retirement benefits that aren't there. So we could look at a deficit of $2.7 to $2.8 billion. And on page 11, you're looking at another $2.3 billion that the governor wants to backfill the inflation proofing. And I guess that would come from, both of those would come from the ERA. They total north of $5 billion at a hit to the ERA. And I'm wondering, if that were the scenario, what impact would that have on the fund?
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, I think the draw is roughly around $2.6 billion. Can't speak to your deficit calculation, but if you added this amount to inflation proofing, what's important to note is this rolls into the corpus of the fund and will be invested in earning the fund's earnings. So this will go and be available to all future generations of Alaskans, not just current generations of Alaskans, this amount here.
Well, the governor stated that in his plan we have about a $2.5 billion deficit. But the problem at this table that we've went over is that he has not included in that calculation tax credits. If we went to the statutory amount that is set into law and the retirement shortfall that the chairman has pointed out, we're looking at a $2.7 to $2.8 billion deficit, and without any new revenues, that the only source besides the CBR, which many people feel that should be left alone for future crises, the only other source is the ERA. And then the governor also plans on trying to backfill the inflation proofing. And on page 11, when you look at 16, 17, 18, and 19, that total is $2.3 billion, which, when you add the two together, that's $5 billion. So, you know, it seems to me that that is too large of a number for a one-year hit to the fund balance of the ERA.
Ms. Riddell, the ERA is invested identical to the permanent fund. Is that accurate?
That is accurate. Both the earnings reserve and the principal own a pro rata share of each investment.
And so the $2.3 billion of possible inflation proofing would be a technical book entry versus a reallocation of asset or an actual hit on the fund?
Correct.
And so the draw still from a financial perspective from the markets would be, if we didn't pass a bill, would be instability in drawing whatever the current budget shortfall is, as Senator Hoffman said, closer, if we count things that haven't been included in the governor's budget, of upwards of $2.7 billion versus the 2.1. And under his proposal, I believe there is a smaller draw on the CBR, which, as Senator Hoffman has said, at least we are being advised, is not the best possible way to use those remaining assets in the CBR. Like the permanent fund is holding in reserves $1 billion to respond to market or legislative or administrative activities, the legislature should hold, according to our budget, best case scenario, 1 year's reserves of general funds, which would be closer to $5 billion, $4.8 billion, where we're down to, as I'm recalling from yesterday, help me, senators, about 2.5 remaining, 2.4. Senator Machicki, did you? Senator Machicki is saying it might be $2.2 billion, and so that's why Senator Hoffman is raising the issue of the draw from the Constitutional Budget Reserve. I just want to make sure I'm accurate in large ways around that conversation. Any other questions from committee members for the Permanent Fund Corporation? Senator Machicki.
I just have one on that subject. I mean, on a year, and so we're a little tighter now in the CBR, right, than we were in the past. But just the difference in earnings last year, if you had $5 billion sitting in savings at a 12% year, $600 million, right?
Yes.
I mean, we've literally, the way that we manage the CBR has literally cost us, many billions of dollars over the years. Do you have suggestions on a better way, in respecting the constitutional requirement of a CBR, yet managing the need for some liquidity in those funds? Liquidity has a bottom line. It seems like we've been unnecessarily prepared for liquidity through the years, and that's been a very expensive way to manage our liquid assets.
Through the chair, Senator Machicki, it's been a challenge for revenue commissioners over the years, from when the subaccount was first created and the recognition that as balances built up, that there was a portion of that, if you remember, could be invested, and then it was promptly lost because it was invested right at the height, right before the loss. So it is a challenge, and I think it does need to be recognized that that money is being relied upon. It's kind of like the discussions we have at our households about what is the appropriate amount to have in savings. Do you have 6 months worth of living expenses, 12 months worth of living expenses in the case of a bad event, in case of an emergency, as to what you should have? And so I think the question you have to ask yourself is, what is the purpose of that fund? Is it to act as a cushion, or is it to fund government and invest accordingly? Because investing as a cushion where you don't expect to use it is a very different strategy than actually using it to fund troopers and education, teachers, and all the other things that Alaskans are relying on the state to pay for.
Senator Machicki.
I think there's an in-between, though, right? There's the your asset allocation in the permanent fund that you're looking for a maximum return, and then there's what we have done with the CBR in the past. There's probably something in between that guarantees a greater return, yet still has a level of conservatism that delivers.
Through the chair, Senator Machicki, I think what's written in statute is actually, it's really interesting, right? It has like a 3-year duration target in statute as to what it can be invested in. And the challenge has been this, and that goes to Bridgewater's observation about the returns on those investments are at historical lows, and we're seeing cash rates at 1.3% versus the 3% we saw in the past. So I think what you're struggling with is the recognition that you have to take a lot of risk to get any return these days, and it's been that way for a while. And if you're willing to take the risk and direct and change the statutes and direct the Department of Revenue to take that risk, they'll take that risk. But right now, their hands are bound by what's in statute on the CBR.
Other questions from committee members?
Just a statement, Madam Chair.
Senator Hoffman?
The CBR was classified as a rainy day fund in cases of emergency, to be used for several things, including the operation of government. So the question is, when is it raining?
Senator Hoffman, we're in Juneau, Alaska. I believe it's situated inside of a rainforest.
But it's sunny today.
It is a beautiful day in Juneau. Ms. Riddell, thank you for presenting in front of Senate Finance today. Mr. Morin, do you have any closing comments for consideration of the Senate Finance Committee on bills that might be either in committee or otherwise that could affect the management of Alaska's prized jewel, Alaska's permanent fund?
Not directly to any of the legislation, but I think, you know, from the board standpoint, I think we would like to emphasize that as long as we have the two-tiered deal, the principal and the earnings reserve, that it would be a mistake to underestimate the importance of the annual inflation proofing. The change in purchasing power over time has a compounding effect. And when we look at the goal of managing for future generations, we can inadvertently shortchange those longer-term values by not recognizing the inflation costs on an ongoing basis.
Senator Olson.
So, Mr. Brown, are you confirming the fears that many of us have that have investments that in the near future there's going to be hyperinflation as predicted, at least by my accountant?
No one can predict the future.
I realize that, but it sounds like the double-digit inflation, the double-digit hyperinflation that I've been cautioned about is almost inevitable. You don't have to comment if you don't want to. I'm just asking if you want to confirm it.
I'm not an expert on that, but I do understand compound interest and the compounding effect, and small changes in the purchasing power turn into large dollar amounts over a long period of time, and it's important to recognize that.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Olson. Is it fair that the board resolution still stands that the people should vote on a percent of market value draw? You had an active resolution giving guidance to the people of Alaska from the board's perspective on how to manage the assets. Is that still an active resolution?
We've discussed that a number of times over the years, and the board's still in favor of a POMV approach to the distributions from the fund.
A percent of market value draw?
Yes.
Thank you. Senator Von Imhoff, did you have a question?
I was going to say, well done.
With that, I would like to advise the committee that tomorrow morning at 9 a.m., we will have the mental health budget in front of us. On Thursday, a presentation update on the Alaska LNG project, and on Friday, a deferred maintenance update. I know that some of those might be riveting conversations to some and maybe not so to others, but it's all important to the business of the people of Alaska. So I thank you for joining us today. I appreciate the comments and look forward to future conversations. With that, we're adjourned.